We've been looking at the Christian life, what it means to live and walk through the power of the Spirit, and we've been looking at various passages these last couple of months in the Gospel of Luke, and we're going to continue that today, and we're going to see a little bit about what it means to have dinner etiquette. Now, when I was in college, I was part of the Navigators Fellowship, and I spent a couple of summers in up north, northern Wisconsin, working at a ski resort. Now, it's the middle of summer, but there's actually a lot of work that needs to be done at a ski resort in the summer, mostly picking rocks off of hills and clearing trees and things like that. And we would always have dinner in their dining hall. And I think after a while, we had a team of probably 25 or so, and we had several tables. And what was noticed by some of our leaders was that we didn't have very good etiquette. And we would pass serving trays or like plates or bowls around, and then they would kind of go one direction or another, and they would all end up with one person having a whole lot of them, and trays going across the table. And so what they decided to do is bring in someone who knew etiquette to teach us proper table manners and etiquette. And most of us didn't even know there was such a thing, but there actually is. Now, part of etiquette is how you set a table. Now, my mother was always very particular about how we set the table, especially if we had guests over, and I could never remember what it was, and so she actually bought me a book on etiquette, which actually gave like pictures of how to set the table, and I remembered that the knife goes on the right. That's the one thing I remember. But as you see, this is like a common American setting, and you have the small like salad fork on the outside and a spoon on the outside, because typically in an American meal you would start with either soup or salad for your first course, and so you start with the outside, and then you work your way in. The knife would probably be for butter for cutting, and then the regular fork. Now, if you have a formal dining, I didn't put a picture of it there, but there can literally be like five or six different glasses and small little knives, and actually like there could be 15 pieces. There's actually a way to put that together, but it is part of etiquette. Now, one of the things we learned at this Navigator camp was how to pass food. And I don't know if anyone knows how to do that, but actually, you pass food in American table counterclockwise. So you pass it to the right. But you always, if you get if you're the first one to get the plate, you actually offer it to the person on your left. And then after offering it to them, they'll take some, and then you pass it to the right. And so we would always say you would fake left and pass right. I guess kind of like sports, but you know, we had to relate it to sports, us guys. But anyway, you know, there's all these different etiquette, and we try to learn from it. I think most kind of a lost art nowadays. But we see here in this passage that Jesus is actually kind of commenting on what was going on at a dinner party and giving some critique in terms of the etiquette of the day. Now, I don't think Jesus was really all that concerned about the fact that these Jewish people at this dinner party were acting in a manner of Jewish etiquette, but he was trying to get to a meaning of how we can live out our life in everything that we do. And so let's go ahead and read our passage, which is in Luke 14:1, and then it's going to skip to verse 7. So let's read that together. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person of more distinguished than you may have been invited. So if the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, "Give this person your seat," then humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, "Friend, move up to a better place." Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Then Jesus said to the host, "When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." And so I think the lesson that we can really see here that we're going to be exploring is to be Christ's example by living humbly. Jesus wasn't that concerned about the etiquette, but he was concerned about how we live out our life in a manner of many different circumstances, and that is living humbly before others and before God. And so the first thing that we see is watchful eyes. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. And so here he's being watched, well, not by an owl, but he was being watched by the Pharisees, the religious rulers. Now, the religious rulers, I think there was mixed motives. They do have a bad rap when we look at them because they did ultimately kill Jesus. But I think they were concerned. Jesus wasn't the only prophet, teacher, rabbi who landed on the scene that began to draw a crowd of people. John the Baptist came before him, but there was actually many, many more prophets that even came before Jesus. Some of them would maybe even what we would consider like cultish figures nowadays. And so they really weren't preaching the truth of God from the Bible. And so it was the religious leaders' responsibility to watch over their flock and to make sure that that no false teaching would get out or their people wouldn't be led astray. And so Jesus now arrives at the scene and all these big crowds are following him. And I think they're rightly concerned because they don't really know if Jesus is really who he says he is. A man from God, the Messiah, the Savior. And so they're watching him closely, and I think their motives, I think, are probably mixed. There's some of them that are probably jealous. You know, Jesus is drawing big crowds, and maybe they don't draw such big crowds at their synagogues. Some of them might be concerned about Jesus' teaching, like, is he teaching the right way? Others may be just not really sure and thinking that, and he was actually accused of being of Beelzebub or the devil, and so basically someone who's not from God, who's really trying to destroy their flock. And so these Pharisees, I think, may have had different motives going into it, but they were carefully watching Jesus. And I think one of the things that they were looking for was the fact if Jesus broke the law in any way, if he sinned in any way, then they can basically make an accusation and say, well, see, Jesus is breaking the law as a lawbreaker. He's outside of the covenant of God, and so we can rightfully discipline him, or even discipline him if he's a heretic, to the point of the death penalty. Because if one bears false witness against God at that time, it could have the death penalty, which would be that of blasphemy. And so they were trying to watch Jesus. Now, part of the problem is that the standard that the Pharisees were holding to Jesus wasn't just that of the law, but it was that of the laws that and regulations that they had enacted in order to protect the law. And so there may be a law about keeping the Sabbath, but then the Pharisees would come up with 20 different rules in order to make sure people didn't break the Sabbath. And so Jesus, in the story that immediately follows verse 1, beginning in verse 2, Jesus is in the house of this Pharisee, and there's a man who has some kind of swelling, and Jesus prays for him, and Jesus heals him. Now, to the Pharisees, they're thinking, he broke the law. Jesus is working on the Sabbath. But then Jesus replied to them and said, which one of you, if you had an ox that fell into a ditch, wouldn't lift them out of the ditch and help your animal? And that basically shut them up, because he knew that all of them, if they had some helpless animal that fell, they would help it up. And how much more would you want to help a person who is in need even on the Sabbath? But nonetheless, the Pharisees, because they constructed this rule of not even seeking to bring healing to people on the Sabbath, they would have considered Jesus a lawbreaker. But Jesus knew that they were watching him, and actually kind of poked them in order to, maybe get some kind of response from them as well. So we see that Jesus did take the time, and he did heal this man, which I think enraged many of the Pharisees. Now, what does this mean to us? Well, I think it means that we are being watched, and I actually had a quote of a really well-known theologian, but I thought, people nowadays, you all know Stephen Curry, right? He's a big basketball star for the Golden State Warriors, and everyone pretty much know he's a Christian. He's very open about his faith, and he said, each game is an opportunity to be on a great stage and to be a witness for Christ. When I step on the floor, people should know who I represent, who I believe in. And I really think that's a good quote, because Jesus was being watched, and so too we are being watched. Now, some that are watching us know we're Christians, and because of that, some may be looking for an excuse. Okay, we're trying to see if you'll stumble or fall in some different way, and most of us inevitably will fall, but they also want to see our reaction to that, and they may be looking for an excuse of why not to follow God. Will look at us, and they just might be curious, and they might be actually contemplating, their life and meaning, and by seeing our lives, that may draw them to Christ. And I think that's what Stefan is getting at, that, when we live our lives, when he's on the court, but when all of us live our lives, we are a witness for Christ, for God, and people are watching us, and we should live in a manner that's worthy of his calling. Now, I think it's interesting. Now, I kind of read news kind of widely, and I like to read from different perspectives. And so I read a lot from the New York Times. It's a very liberal publication, keeps me a little connected to New York. But I also like to read the Wall Street Journal, which is a very conservative publication. And so they have very different viewpoints, but I like to kind of see where people are thinking in the world. And this happens to be in the New York Times. And what's actually interesting in the Times is it's a very secular, liberal publication, and so for the most part, their viewpoint towards Christians and Christianity is negative. And so a lot of times in the articles or comments, they basically think of Christians as backward people at best, and probably destructive, and anti-culture, anti-society at worst. But nonetheless, even the Times, when it comes to Christians doing good, will highlight stories. It's like they don't want to acknowledge that Christians can do good and actually do good, but they'll run these stories nonetheless. And so there was a story about this couple which works with a Southern Baptist a relief arm of them, and they go out, and when there's disasters, if there's earthquakes or flooding or whatever, they send out teams to go and help the people. And the government, in this article, government officials actually acknowledge that it's the Christians that are typically on the scene first, even before the governmental authorities. And so they acknowledge that Christians are of some help and some usefulness. And and the New York Times actually, in the headline of the story was something to the effect that for these relief workers, it's not just a job, it's a calling. Now, they're volunteers, but they feel that this is their calling from God to help others who are in need. And so this is Martin and Wiley Blankenship, and this was in 2011, where they were helping some tornado victims. And so, and I've seen this again and again, where there's a disaster, and the Times will highlight the fact that these Christians are doing good. And I think that's kind of a good way of being that witness that we're called to be. When we do good, when we seek to help others, when we bring things like disaster relief or meet the needs of the poor or reach the downcast, it can't help but get others to notice, especially those who might not even be for God or who might be anti-God. And so in this way, we can really let our light shine before men, that others will see our good works and glorify our Father who is in heaven. Now, the second thing that we see here in this passage is table assignments. Now, for those of us who've been married, we probably had some kind of reception. And if you had tables that were, throughout the banquet hall or something, usually one of the tasks that you have to do is table assignments. This can actually lead to some interesting scenarios and tensions, because you start thinking, well, I have this one friend and they're coming from out of town, but no one else knows them in the whole place, so who would they get along with? And so you want to probably place them with someone that you think they would get along with. And then, of course, there's like an aunt and an uncle that of the same family who've been arguing with each other for 20 years, and you actually don't want them near each other because you don't want a scene, so you try to put them in different places. And so the manner of table seating can actually be more complicated than it looks. Now, when Grace and I got married, we just sat a few tables of family, and then we figured the rest of the 10, 15, 20 tables, I don't know how many we had at our Chinese banquet, we figured they could seat themselves. But there's certain people that we did want to have seated. And so this is something that, table assignments is something that even happens in American and probably Chinese culture when it comes to wedding and events. And the same was the case back in Jesus' time. And so Jesus said, when someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. And then he goes on and explains, like we had read, that if you take a place of honor, and then someone who's even more honorable than you, or of more high social standing than you, you're sitting like in their spot, then they're going to remove you, put you at a lower place, and then you're going to look bad. And so Jesus is like, don't be seeking these places of honor. Actually, take the seat of dishonor, and then maybe the host will elevate you and put you in a better place, and then everyone will see how honored of a guest that you are. And so rather than fight for position, it's best to actually take a place of less prominence. And then Jesus said, for those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And so for Jesus, it's not just about the table settings and the manners at a wedding feast, but that in our lives we should seek to humble ourselves. And when we do humble ourselves, ultimately we will be exalted by God. Now, there was a couple of social structures going on at the time. Now, they were in the Roman Empire, and in the Roman Empire, there was a social structure of basically the ruling class, so the senators and Caesar, of course, but that those of his family, those would be kind of the highest upper class. And then there was kind of landowners and rich and educated, who was kind of the second tier. And then there was citizens. Roman citizens were the third tier. Fourth tier were freed slaves, and so somehow they bought their way or got their freedom. And then the last class was actual slaves. And so in the Roman Empire, of which Israel was in at the time, had that structure. And then in Judaism, you actually had their own structure, which basically was, well, the king would probably be in the middle too, like a king and the royalty, his family. And then priests would be the highest level, and then Levites. Now, Levite is a tribe of priests, so all priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. Does that make sense? So in this tribe of Levites, all of them did priestly functions or worked in the temple, but not all of them were officially priests. So maybe a percentage, I don't know what it was, 25% of Levites actually served as priests in the temple, but the rest of them didn't serve as priests, but they would go to the temple and do cleaning, and they would set up all of the you know, the different things for, you know, the sacrifices for worship, they would be the ones who kind of set up things or greeted people or whatever. I think that the temple was just a huge complex, and so they needed a lot of workers, and the Levites were those workers. But not all of them were priests, so the priests would have the most prominence, followed by the Levites, those who were of the priestly tribe, and then, I don't know why it says Joseph, but basically Jewish people, just your common average citizen who is a follower of Yahweh. And then the next level was tax collectors and outcasts. And so a tax collector could be a Jewish person, but they were basically had a very low opinion. People had a very low opinion of them because they were viewed as trying to extort the people of God. And then you had Samaritans, which were those who were of the surrounding region just north of Jerusalem. And those were kind of like half-breed. They had their roots in Judaism and Hebrew, but they intermarried with the people of the land, and they began to worship not in Jerusalem, but in another place in Samaria. And then finally, Gentiles are the ones that are basically on the outside. And so when there was this wedding banquet, there was both of these kind of structures, these social structures that were playing out. And so there may have been, maybe it's a Jewish wedding, and they knew some Roman officials. And so those Roman officials, if they were like senators or something, they would get places of prominence. But also if it was a priest, they would get a place of prominence. And then the Levites would get the next place. And so if you were a Gentile friend, you'd probably be in a back row somewhere. And so Jesus is basically acknowledging that there is these social structures. He's not actually advocating against the social structures. He's not saying this is a bad structure or anything. He's just teaching how we should relate, how people should relate within the structures, and that's basically, as we have seen, with humility. And I think this verse actually summarizes it really well in Romans 12:3. The Apostle Paul said, "For by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourselves more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you." And so I think that's what we're trying, that we're called to do, to not think of ourselves more highly than we ought. Now, I was reading an article in the Times, actually this past week, and they were talking about how segmented our American society is, and you see that segmentation in race. So, you know, people who are black and people who are white in particular tend to hang out with their own kind. But they said, actually, the biggest breakdown or differentiation of people is by education. And so those who are educated, those who are with college degrees or above, tend to relate mostly with those who have college degrees. And so they ask the question, you know, of your five best friends, you know, who are they? Are they college educated or are they not college educated? And college educated people were like, of their five best friends, most of them were maybe 4.5 were college educated. And then they asked those who only had a high school diploma or less, who are your friends? And 4 out of 5 would say basically it was people who didn't have college education. And so the breakdown, actually, interestingly enough, wasn't so much by race, but actually by education. But basically, what I'm trying to get at here is Jesus wants us to break down those barriers, those walls. He wants us not to just hang out with those people that we're most comfortable with, but he wants the church to be made up of people from every class of society, every race, every people, every tribe, every tongue. And so that may actually take some work on our part, some intentionality that we move beyond the groups that we would normally and most comfortably hang out with. I actually think that in the Catholic Church, they probably do that better than in the Protestant Church. The Catholic Church has a very standard liturgy. And so whether you go to church here or in Wisconsin or Italy, it's pretty much the same liturgy, other than maybe the language might be different. And so people aren't looking so much for, I want to go to a church that has contemporary worship, or I want more gospel worship, or this kind of preacher, that kind of preacher. They're just looking to go to church, which is familiar. And what it does is it tends to bring people from all different backgrounds together, which is interesting. But nonetheless, I think God's calling each of us to break beyond and to relate to people who are different than ourselves. One of my friends in college was really good at this. She would just always be, you know, we'd be in the lunch line or something, and then later on you'd see her like behind the lunch line talking to the workers. And so like she intentionally sought to get to know people that she normally wouldn't think of her even talking to, but she really wanted to kind of break beyond, you know, like even a student worker type division. So we see table assignments. The last thing that we see here that Jesus speaks about is dinner invitations. Well, who should we invite to dinner? Now, Jesus says, but when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. And so, typically, and as Jesus said right before this, we would tend to want to invite our friends, maybe our family, maybe those that are more prominent than ourselves. And oftentimes, you might invite someone, and Jesus is kind of acknowledging you invite people that are close to you or who are like you, and it's very likely that they will invite you back, and there's some reciprocity there in terms of invitation. But Jesus says, don't seek to do that, because then you will have your reward, but rather invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. Invite those, again, that are beyond our social circle. And in this case, it's even those who would be on the lowest and the lowest strata of society. Now, I can't help but mention Mother Teresa, and if you have been following the news, this is actually a big weekend because she is being canonized, I believe the word would be, as a saint in the Catholic Church. Now, the Catholic Church, when they have saints, it's basically like their Hall of Fame. Like, there's Cooperstown, which is the Baseball Hall of Fame. Like, you go there and you celebrate the greatest baseball players of all time. And basically, saints for Catholics are the greatest Christians of all time. And they basically just lived out the life of Christ in a way that's exemplary and that that can really be modeled and that can be looked upon favorably. And as an example before us. Now, Mother Teresa served in Calcutta. She basically worked with the poorest of the poor, the downcast, the outcast, those who were terminally ill and those that pretty much society had disposed of. And she began a mission group called, I think, the Sisters of Charity, which began in Calcutta but now is basically around the world, basically helping people and running, you know, help for medical care and hospice care and the like. And so this has really expanded even since her death. It's interesting, actually, some of the articles that have come out now have been kind of anti-Mother Teresa, and there's one particular physician in England who's from Indian descent that basically his life goal, he said, is to destroy Mother Teresa. Like, he wants to totally discredit her. And partly he thinks because, you know, she gave Calcutta a bad name. Like, he's like, these poor people didn't have to go to her. They could have gone to other hospitals. And she was trying to convert them, and that's the worst thing. And I'm like, actually, that's part of the Christian message. You try to convert people and share the gospel. So I don't really buy his arguments, but the church has basically responded, well, our saints aren't perfect. We acknowledge that, but in spite of their flaws, there's still people who sought God with their whole heart and sought to live out the life of the gospel, and so that's what she did. And for many of us, you know, she lived during my time and someone that I remembered. There's a story or a quote of Mother Teresa that I read just the other day, and it said an American cameraman, like a videographer, was a documentarian in India, stood in awe as he watched Mother Teresa lovingly clean infected wounds of a horribly disfigured leper. Sister, he commented, I wouldn't do that for $1 million. Her response, neither would I, brother, neither would I. And so Mother Teresa wasn't in it for the money. She wasn't in it just for the sake of doing it, but she was in it in order to demonstrate the love of God to people who were in most need. And I think that's what Jesus is calling to us as well, to seek to meet the needs of others and to thereby show his love. And so what are lessons, or maybe the lesson that we can learn today? Well, it's be Christ's example by living humbly. We are being watched by those who know Christ, but especially by those who don't know Christ. And as we seek to live out the gospel in our lives, we're called to live humbly. We're called not to think more highly than ourselves, but we're also called to seek to meet the needs of others, especially those who are in need, great need, and those who even are not too much like us. And as we do that, I think we can really be a witness in the world. And as I had alluded to, quoted earlier, I think this is really summed up by Jesus' words in Matthew 5:16. He said, "Let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven." And so as we seek to live out the gospel, this will be an example towards others, and those who are not following God, even writers and editors of the New York Times, they can see that there's something different amongst Christians, and indeed God can be glorified as they, even in their own way, give praise to the Lord. So let's thank God and come to him in prayer. Heavenly Father, we do thank you and praise you for your word. And we acknowledge, Lord, that we probably have a long ways to go. We tend to hang out with our own tribe and not really seek to go beyond the people that we really like or know. But Lord, you're calling us to break barriers, and you're calling us to love others and to meet the needs of others. And Lord, it's really not so much about us, but it's about our living out the gospel for your glory. So help us, Lord, to be a light that shines before others, that indeed you may be glorified in heaven. So we thank you in Christ's name. Amen.